You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm John Allen. I'm the president of the Brookings Institution, and it is a great pleasure to welcome you all here today to Building the Workforce of the Future, Resilient People and Places, which is a symposium co-hosted by the Brookings Center for Universal Education and our Future of the Middle Class initiative. This symposium brings together the economic development and education communities to discuss strategies for addressing the future of work and, of course, the skills needed in a changing world. Both of these communities are understandably concerned about the development of resilient peoples and places in this fast-changing, technology-driven market. But often, these communities are not in the same conversation. Today, we hope to facilitate that important conversation and that connection. And to that end, we're very pleased to be joined by a true leader in this field, the MasterCard Center for Inclusive Growth. Now, after receiving its federal tax break in 2018, MasterCard did what few corporations dared to do. And with that landmark windfall, invested back into society by growing their Center for Inclusive Growth through a $500 million investment. Now, Brookings was honored to be among the first of its grantees, and much of the research you'll hear about later today was made possible specifically because of MasterCard's philanthropic vision and its investment. I'd like to personally recognize Parag Mehta, who will join us a bit later, who is the executive director of the Center for Inclusive Growth, as well as his colleagues, for their generous support for our work in this field. Now, later this afternoon, you'll also hear about breakthrough research that Brookings is conducting on work with low-wage workers and what it will take for them to engage in lifelong learning and to seize opportunities for upward mobility. For this, I'd like to thank Google.org and Andrew Dunkelman for his great support, and he leads their education and economic opportunity efforts, and our sincere thanks to that organization and to Andrew for his consistent encouragement and support there as well. And now onward on to today's programming. We've convened policymakers, practitioners, researchers, and thought leaders from government and corporation and nonprofit sectors. We've done this to discuss education and economic development strategies that can provide locally relevant solutions to enhance economic and social mobility. You'll also hear about some new research that Brookings senior fellow Marcela Escobari is doing to include into a report called Growing Cities That Work for All, a capability-based approach to regional economic competitiveness. And we're very proud of that work, as well as additional work and collaboration that Marcela is doing with Brookings fellow Martha Ross on strategies for reskilling low-wage workers. So it's our mission today for you to leave with actionable insights into what is required to build an inclusive economy, and to do so into the future where all Americans can participate on a basis of equality. It's something I know all of us here are deeply concerned about and care about in a very important way. And I want to thank you all for joining us this morning for this event. In just a few short moments, I'll ask Rebecca Winthrop, Brookings Senior Fellow and Director of the Center for Universal Education, to take the stage to speak more on the framing of the day and the important work of her center. And Rebecca's own research focuses on education globally, in particular promoting quality education for the most marginalized. And she explores how education innovations can leapfrog educational progress. And you would be hard-pressed to find a better leader and an expert to kick off the substance of today's symposium. Two housekeeping notes. We are going out over webcast. So for those of you joining us on the Internet, you're most welcome today, and we're grateful for your presence. And this is very much on the record. So, ladies and gentlemen, if you would, please join me in welcoming to the stage Brookings Senior Fellow and Director Rebecca Winthrop. Thank you very much.
Wow, what a warm welcome. I should take you everywhere with me, John. Welcome to everybody. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for those of you who are on the webcast. And John, thank you for your leadership. Those of you who are not Brookings scholars may not know that this is a topic today that is very near and dear to John's heart. He has been championing it since he came in. So it's a real pleasure to just give you a few words of what we're going to be doing today. We've got a packed schedule. This is our Center for Universal Education's Spring Research and Policy Symposium. We pick a different topic every year. And for those of you who don't know about our work at the center, we work on education and skilling across the lifespan from early childhood on up and around the globe. We have a deep commitment to the importance and benefits of sharing lessons across borders. And the UN Sustainable Development Goal, which on education, which came about not too long ago, focuses on lifelong learning. And we thought it would be a perfect opportunity to dive in deeply in the U.S. The U.S. is part of the globe, after all, and look at lifelong learning. And we are really, really grateful to our partners across the institution who we are doing this with and co-hosting with, most particularly the Future of the Middle Class Initiative. This is a cross-Brookings initiative. A big thanks to Richard Reeves, who's the director of it, who's been deeply engaged in brainstorming from the beginning what we should be thinking about and framing. A big thanks to Camille Bousset, who herself embodies cross-Brookings collaboration. She's appointed to not a dual appointment, but to three different programs, governance studies, economic studies, metropolitan studies. So we're really thrilled about that. The initiative is really focused on improving the quality of life for Americans in the middle class and increasing the number of people who can join the middle class. And this is a very hot topic. I think many of you in the room probably work on it yourselves or read about it in the paper. This idea of our changing economy and the implications it has for people's lives is of grave concern to many of us, particularly here in the U.S., but also around the world. And there are two things that I'm particularly excited about today. One is I love, frankly, personally, nothing better than crossing boundaries, whether they're national boundaries or disciplinary boundaries, to come up with diverse approaches and insights to create new solutions. And we're going to be doing we've been doing that, and we're going to be sharing that with you today. We really wanted the tenor of the conversation to be solutions focused. And really try to think differently about what can we do about this phenomena and this topic. We will have, as John referenced earlier, we will have some really interesting research that we're doing together with the Metropolitan Studies Program and their scholars that takes from the field of global economic development some data and analysis approaches and applies them to U.S. cities. And that has actually been really helpful in helping think through what we need to do for building both resilient places and resilient people. And the other thing, which John also mentioned that I think is really helpful, is to bring the economic development conversation together with the education conversation. This is not a topic where you can educate your way out of it alone. It's also not a topic where you can create jobs and build growth alone without building the talent and pipeline for that. So you need both in the same room. So with that, that's sort of our goal today. And what we're going to do is kick off with a scene setting, framing discussion, and keynote, which I'll tell you about a little bit in a minute. We'll have a coffee break. We'll move into a session that's really looking at building resilient places. We'll have a networking lunch. Feel free to stick around, join us, grab your food, talk to other people. After lunch, we'll be focusing on how to build resilient people, looking at the K-12 system and also higher education, lifelong learning. And then we'll close the day by looking at how these issues come together in one particular place in Northern Virginia. And then we'll have drinks, alcohol, food at the end of the day. So if you make it through, that is your reward. No, we have a lot of fantastic people joining us, and I'm very grateful. I just want to say a word of thanks. You will see a few of us repeatedly throughout the day. I'm very grateful to Marcella Escobari, Jim Shelton, Camille Bousset. The four of us have been sort of thinking throughout the last couple months about how to frame the day, what the topics are, who to invite, how to curate this conversation. So you will see us moderating different discussions as the day goes on. So thank you, guys, all of you. So to kick us off, I am really pleased to have Representative Rokana with us and co-founder of Automation Anywhere, Neeti Mehta, with us, who's going to have a conversation from California's 17th district, both as a political representative and as a CEO of a major company in that district. There's no one better, I think, to frame the conversation than my friend and colleague Jim Shelton, who has spent many years in government service as the Deputy Secretary of Education for the Department of Education. Most recently was heading the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative's education program and is soon to join us as a non-resident senior fellow here at Brookings. He thinks very deeply about how to make people's lives better in this country. He's very reflective and incredibly passionate and committed about making a difference. So, Jim, welcome to the stage.
So, good morning. Yeah, so I know this is a normal Brookings thing, but I'm from education, so when I say good morning, you say,
good morning.
I got it. Very good. So I need to say thank you as well for the extremely generous introduction. I think that one of the things that's really started to come to mind for me is that the reality is, despite all the things you hear in an introduction, for me, I have to remember myself as an ordinary man who had extraordinary opportunity. An ordinary man who had extraordinary opportunity, and because of that, I've been able to do a lot of things in my life. And if we each think about the opportunities that we've had and how it's shaped the context that we're in, the experiences that we have, and the relationships that we have, and recognize that the role that is played in the arc of our lives, then it puts a lot of the rest of this work in context. Now, having said all that, I do have one superpower. Somebody asked me this, like, to do a little icebreaker the other day, and I was like, what is my superpower? And it is, I consistently can place myself in circles where I'm surrounded by people who are much smarter and better than I am. So I'm honored to be here with Rebecca and the team and having met Marcella. So sometimes it is much better to be lucky than good. And there was a part to the frame that I'm going to talk about that I just could not figure it out. And literally my first day, I wound up sitting down next to Marcella and was like, she's about to answer this question for me. So let me jump in really quickly. I think it's really important for us to remember that, I got to stand here at this podium. I think it's important for us to remember that for a lot of people, frankly for all of us, there's a reason that we should keep referencing Great America. Our stated ideals, the leadership we've been able to have over the last century or two almost, the role that we played in the world, there are reasons that we refer to America being great. And yet, the world is getting scary to people. And for good reason. Now, by now, many of you, if not all of you, are familiar with the Raj Chetty data. Raj Chetty used big data for the first time from the IRS to map what has happened to people's incomes over time and was able to show what exactly has happened to the American dream. Now, what this chart shows is the percent of Americans who could expect to do better, who actually did better than their parents in terms of annual income. And what you can see, basically, is that in the 1940s, about 90% of Americans could expect to do better than their parents. And at the last you could calculate, we dropped to that being about half. So this insecurity, this sense that we're not doing better, that the promise of being able to do better than your parents if you did what you were asked, it feels at risk. And in fact, for many Americans, it actually is at risk. It's not happening anymore. Now, other things have been happening, like our quality of life overall has been going up. We've made tremendous strides in progress, but this feeling is real. And it's exacerbated by two things. On the right-hand side, what you see is the inequality that we know all too well. And this is about income. That's not even about wealth yet. On the left-hand side is a chart created by the Economic Innovation Group that describes where 50% of the jobs came from after the last recession. And basically, 50% of the jobs grew in 3% of the counties. So what that means is that those people who are saying opportunity is happening in America, just not near us, like what they feel is real too. Right? And if someone frames that for you around, well, what are those people? Who is getting those jobs? Then all of a sudden you associate who's getting opportunity, who's not getting opportunity, not necessarily with the macroeconomic trends, but with the people who seem to be getting what you wish you had. The numbers are real. How we frame them, up to us. So what does that translate into? Again, with Chetty's data, he showed us that pretty much, if you look on the left-hand side, nationally, red is, as usual, not great. Blue is better. Red is where you are not likely to do better than your parents. And what you can see is at the national level, there's a higher degree of variance across the country. But most importantly, when you look within communities, that same level of disparity, if not greater disparity, actually exists. Now think about that. That means in the same communities, the same levels of resources, roughly speaking, same companies. If you look at Washington, D.C., which we'll talk about at the end of the day, you are unfortunately not surprised to see that on one part of the city, people do really well, even doing better than their parents, who are probably doing pretty well themselves. In another part of the city, even though their parents were probably not doing very well at all, they're still not able to surpass them. So I want us to stop for a second on this particular note, because what this means is that, again, back to this promise, despite all of our best efforts, whether they were place-based or national, we're still in a position where you live and who your parents are most determinant of your life chances, at least. You may be able to beat the odds, but your chances are most predicted by who your parents are and where you grow up. Now, I don't know what you were taught, but I was not taught that that's the way America is supposed to work. So what does all that mean for Americans who have actually been behind for a long time? Well, one of the first things that we need to recognize is, again, from the Raj Chetty data, he disaggregated the data. He found something really, really interesting. Definitely, you see systemic bias across populations. Wage differences, income growth differences, et cetera, et cetera. But in particular, he found for African-American males that even if you actually made it to the upper rungs of income, which begins to, for most populations, inoculate you from the likelihood of falling behind and even your future generations falling behind, for African-American males, that's actually just not the case. In much larger percentages, they fall not even down a rung, but down two, three, even back to the bottom. Now, I say this because we often think about the challenge of the future of work in the context of addressing the first couple of things I talked about. The fact that the changing landscape is coming, that what we'll hear about in a little bit in terms of automation is going to displace jobs, that the mismatch of skills in the economy is actually making it harder and harder for Americans to do better. That is all true. But it is also true, and we must recognize, that we weren't built on a perfect system before. That embedded in our system, in our laws, in our way of life, has been, whether it was from slavery or a lack of women's rights or the transfer of the feudal system to many parts of American society in terms of folks who started off as sharecroppers and whose families may still live in very, very similar circumstances. That inequity is built in. That bias is built into our systems. And it actually influences decisions and the resources that we allocate today. As we recognize this, It means that the solutions that we're going to talk about have to not only overcome the challenges of the future, but actually compensate for the challenges of the past. Now, I just want to remind people of one really simple thing. Does everyone remember the concept of compounding interest? Okay. So if you don't remember when someone told you to remember to start planning your retirement, and they're like, and the earlier you start, the better off you are. And if you start too late, it's too late. You can't make up for it later on. So one thing to just remember is, what's about the people who started saving two generations before you did? How do you catch up? Can you catch up? And so if the compounding math basically means that the inequity is built in a way that can't be overcome, what does that mean about the level of transformational change we have to find a way to make in order to begin to even talk about equity, let alone equality? So, to the solution side. You know, the fundamental problem that we have to solve is actually relatively straightforward. This is where I'm going to try and bring it back up. I'm sorry. I should have warned him. I'm not really the great first speaker. I'm kind of a downer. But the simple, but highly complex problem is that when it comes to human development, there are a set of milestones, and I borrowed lots of this from the great work here at that Beth Sawhill did at Brookings and in partnership with folks from Urban Institute, that there are certain milestones of no surprise to anyone, but that actually are well-grounded in the data, that unless you make it across successfully, your likelihood of achieving thriving adulthood go down with every milestone that you miss. And so if we then want to get millions more population level change, it means we have to get millions more people to cross through all or versions of all of these milestones so that they can actually be prepared to live as thriving adults. Now, we've been working on this for a while, but there are reasons to believe that, one, there are solutions in the world that work today that we can actually put into place. And second, that we actually have the ability to scale them in a way that people can afford in ways that we haven't before. Both of those things are really critically important. I'm going to assert that one of the biggest drivers of inequality is our inability to scale what people need to thrive affordably. And because we don't formulate the problem that way, we wind up missing really important parts to the solution. Each one of those words is important. The other is we have people getting caught in impediments to progress that we actually know a lot about now how to deter. Unplanned pregnancy, criminal justice system, mental health and addiction, extreme violence. We don't have complete solutions to any of these things, but we have partial and great solutions in many cases to many of them, oftentimes that we still don't make accessible. So the question for us is, when there is a solution that is known, what gets in our way of actually getting it done? Now, another part to the reason that we don't seize the opportunity to actually make dramatic change in these different areas is because we tend to think about them as fragmented issues. We think about individual development and education separate from the environment and the social environment that people find themselves in and who they know and their social capital that they can bring. We think about it as separate from the built environment that they're in, the availability of amenities and services in their communities, the cost of housing and how it eats into their work. We say that we think about all of these things, but we think about all of them separate from each other. And it is actually only when you can actually bring them all together in a systemic form that you get the compounding effect on the positive side of someone having the tools and resources to develop themselves, having the resources and connections to actually find opportunity, having the housing and stability and access to services to actually be able to build a thriving life, and then being in an economy that gives you the opportunity to actually put all of that to good work and build a prosperous future for yourself and your family. And this is the question I said. I could kind of see how to do all three of those, but it was not until I connected with Marcella, where she's going to talk about later, about how to be deliberate about building economies and matching skills to those economies to let people thrive. We spend a lot of money attracting people to open businesses that may or may not actually be benefiting the people we hope to serve. This is her work. We have not only new tools in this area, We have new tools and resources and knowledge that we have about how to actually educate and develop people, how to accelerate the pace of learning, how to actually identify earlier when people need specific kinds of supports and scaffolding to make the transitions. These are all things where new knowledge and tools and resources create the opportunity for the kind of leapfrogs that Rebecca talked about. These are the things that we want to start to frame today as solutions. We'll only touch on a piece of them, but it begins to lay the frame for many more to come. The kinds of things that I want to close talking about are the kinds of things we need to consider as we talk about solutions going forward. You know, I've had the opportunity to work in the private sector, in government, in the nonprofit and philanthropic sector. And the frustration I had when I left the administration was I could not figure out why these things still, having worked in those sectors, were not coming together. And the reality is that often because we all approach our work without taking into consideration everything. And the Einstein quote I love most is, everything should be as simple as it can be, but no simpler. So we're not going to solve poverty and mobility in a simple way. We have to actually figure out what the elements are. So I already talked about the more systemic approach. We also need to recognize when we're talking about people, it takes holistic approaches. We've seen this, want to separate these notions of the soft skills and the hard skills, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, whatever language you want to use. But it is only when people have all the things they need to actually be able to develop and thrive that they're able to make full progress and realize their potential. It's only when we begin to think about how these things land in place, because everything lands in a place, and that place context is different, and that'll be something that Marcella talks about, that you can think about the kind of specific solutions and how to leverage the assets and infrastructure that happen to be in those places. It's only when you think about how to achieve population-level scale, getting it to all the people who need it, and design that in from the beginning, that you recognize that the private sector, especially the philanthropic sector or the nonprofit sector, cannot do it without the public vision in mind. It also means that you don't focus on building bespoke solutions that are only going to serve a few. You have to design for scale in the beginning. Last couple. Having worked across the sectors, I can tell you we all operate with caricatures of what the other sectors think and try and do, even when we're trying to do the same work. And if we don't find a way to get much more intentionally cross-sector, to make the policy incentive such that they make the right thing to do the easier thing to do or the thing that gets rewarded, to create space for the private sector to do what they do best around innovation and scaling, to take advantage of the philanthropic resources to fill gaps where the markets may fail and to do the kind of innovation work that can push us forward. If we don't find ways to weave those things together, the likelihood that we're going to make the kinds of systemic change at the pace that we need is actually relatively low. We've got to work faster, and we've got to work together to do it. Those two things don't often go together, but if we don't figure it out, the likelihood of our success goes down dramatically. Last two things. We tend not, especially in our place-based work, especially around complex issues, to try and wire ourselves for learning. Therefore, we do and repeat the same things over and over again, neither getting the insight from what works nor recognizing what fails, so we don't repeat the mistakes. So we have to build our communities in ways and the data infrastructure and things like that so we can actually begin to understand which of these supports and services and interventions are working for the people we're trying to serve. You can imagine if we actually had that kind of infrastructure working across many, many cities, folks that are smart like the people here at Brookings could figure out how to identify the patterns of what works for whom and in what context. But without that infrastructure, we're struck with trying to gather data from a variety of fragmented sources, mostly latent data, and guessing. Said that way, it's not hard to see that's not a smart path. And then finally, I thought a lot about this last one, because the reality is I talk to my sons a lot about, like, when you want to achieve great things. So there are four questions. But the first question is always, what do you believe? Like, what do you believe is possible? What do you believe you can do? And I believe that's true for organizations and, frankly, for countries as well. And so if we don't start to cut at the heart of what people believe the potential of others are, what we believe our responsibility is to create real opportunity for everyone, we don't begin to go after that in very clear ways where we address the narrative that is starting to actually pull us apart even more than before, and then sustain that the likelihood that we run into the ceiling of our imaginations and of our generosity and our will to push goes down dramatically. So the work of narrative change, the work of getting people to believe and to use that language and then incorporate that into how they problem solve, that work is also important as well. I know all of you just need the data. But for everyone else, we need to tell a story that lets them understand why the future lies in the work ahead. And with that, I will end my talk to get you to the people of substance. Yeah, so I'll take my seat if you would, too, would join me. Great. You guys still with us?
Yes.
Okay. Again, this is like the education thing, like call and response. You guys still with us?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. So, welcome. First, let me, you've been slightly introduced to Miti Netta from Automation Anywhere and Representative Rokana from the 17th District in California. We're going to spend a few minutes talking, but there'll be an opportunity for you to ask questions at the end. I'm going to actually start with you, Miti. Sorry. Because everyone seems to have this broad conception that the future of work is hazardous or has risks in it for many, many Americans. I think people have visions of like robots like taking out whole jobs and not taking out other jobs. But your company is in the business of thinking about the various ways in which automation will play out through society, through companies, and you are pushing for thinking about how it impacts whole communities. So what I'd love is if you did two things. One is to both explain how your company works and what does it really look like in terms of the work that's done. And then the second is, what does that look like when it impacts a company or a community? Especially on the, let's get clear about what happens in terms of when productivity increases and people lose jobs.
First of all, thank you for having me. It's absolutely a pleasure to be here. Automation is a reality. Automation is here today. And technology in history and today has always been about human enablement. So how can we bring technology so that humans can be better off in the long term? That's the purpose of technology. If you look at any industrial revolution that we've had so far, in any context, whether it was mechanical, industrial, technological, it has advanced society. Now, what we want to make sure is that technology is part of the conversation as we uplift society. We are innovating there, but are we actually bringing society with us with this innovation? Automation Anywhere is in the robotic process automation and digital workforce space. So we basically create software robots that will enable people to get rid of the repetitive and mundane work that they do.
Because you said robots. Say that. What does that mean?
So software robots is just anything that you can kind of get a computer to do. It's specific technology that's a little bit democratized, and I'll talk about that. So, for example, automation in a traditional sense is something that you code. You know, it's a two-year endeavor. A company decides, oh, you know, this process has to be automated. It's too manual. It's taking too long. There are too many errors. You hire a bunch of coders, you code through it, you put a lot of money into it, finally the automation is ready, and the process has changed. There's compliance, there's governance, there's new customer needs. And so often automation basically was not viable, either economically or commercially. And so what RPA and the digital workforce has done is democratize this automation. Basically, it's a tool or a software that you can learn very easily and allows people to take care of the repetitive and mundane. So we've created so many different applications. I mean, if you think about a large enterprise in the U.S., they use anywhere between 2,000 and 3,000 different applications in their business. Now, just imagine the amount of data and the processes and the information passing between systems. And there's a lot of repetitive and mundane work, which is really not knowledge-based. It doesn't bring into account human skill set, the creativity, the innovation that you can bring as a human, which machines can't. And so this digital workforce basically allows humans to take care of the repetitive and mundane. And so whether it's one person, whether it's a division, whether it's a team, whether it's a company, whether it's a country, basically it puts that in the hands of the people to get rid of that and get to that next level. So I'll give you one quick statistic in that, is that based on all the automation that we see in the last 20, 30 years, we believe we've automated maybe 20 to 30% of everything that can be automated. With RPA and the digital workforce, we believe we'll get to about 60 to 70%. And so if you think about what is possible...
Is there a time frame?
If any large enterprise, then we're talking about the next 2 years, if that. So if... couple of things. One is, just think what we've accomplished with 20 to 30% of automation. We've been to the moon, increased lifespan, brought up world wealth, taken care of certain diseases, et cetera, et cetera. And so now think with 70% automation, what can be possible and what we can bring to the table. That's one part of it. Two is the RPA and digital workforce industry is predicted to be anywhere in the future to about $100 billion. Which is a huge industry. This is about having, for example, today's jobs. A lot of us use computers at work. Can you imagine going to work without a computer, especially in certain types of jobs? It's not possible. We believe the same for these software bots. We believe every human will be enabled by software bots to help it reach that next level of creativity, next level of knowledge work, next level of whatever they bring to the workplace. And that's the power of automation when it is democratized, which is what this does.
So let me push on that just a little bit. So you have a new $100 billion industry. There'll be employment associated with that. I don't know if you know what those numbers look like. Those things that that industry allows to be automated will eliminate the need for portions of jobs or whole jobs in the process. Do you have a sense of the impact on jobs of that level of automation?
So we don't have... an exact answer for that, of course. But what we see is that we created these jobs in the last 20, 30 years that dealt with a lot of data and a lot of repetition with that data. And so, yes, so every vertical, every industry, any country, every single industry will be impacted by this, 100%. So all industries will have certain jobs that might become a little bit more redundant than others, for example. But today, for example, we don't have telephone operators moving, connecting lines manually. Those jobs are gone. But we have better communications, which led to a whole other industry, which led to so many other industries and so many more innovations around it. Similarly, with this, we believe that some of the repetitive mundane jobs will kind of transition out, for want of a better word. But we haven't seen big job displacement yet. Because if you talk to most people in most industries, especially computer-related work, you'll say that about 20, 30% of their day is spent in admin work, is spent in repetitive work. They really don't want to do it. You know, transferring data from Excel to another application, or, copying and pasting, or creating that same report again and again. You know, that's not knowledge work. And they are very happy to get rid of that. It frees them up to think big, think outside the box, think with that data and see what else is possible. So by and large, we believe, yes, there will be some transition, and that is why technology should be part of this conversation. How do we transition it better than we have in the past? But it is for the better. If we believe that this technology is going to get us to a better level of society, better level of work, better level of medical or better level of logistics, telecommunications, healthcare, it doesn't matter, then we must invest in it, we must train people for it, and we must transition through it.
Thank you for that. And so two things inherent in what you described. One is that transition, So there'll be a lot of change in roles. Some roles may be completely eliminated. And that disruptive force will hit companies and communities as they figure out how to make the transition. Probably based on what you said, at an accelerated rate compared to others. The second is, for people to move to the higher value at work, they have to have the skills for that. Is that fair?
Absolutely.
Okay, and so there's a mandate around the skills and competencies people need to be developing to be able to play at the next level. So, Representative Khanna, I wanted to talk to you about, you've been pretty vocal on several different fronts. One is, for those who don't know, 17th District is in California. A lot of tech companies, like some of the biggest, and if not the companies, then their founders live in your district. You spend a lot of time, though, talking about the responsibility of the tech industry. You also talk a lot about the change that's coming and how it's impacting not only your district, but the rest of the country. So I'd love for you to just talk about, broadly speaking, how you see the future of work, the risks at hand, and how we need to lean into it.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Jim, for your excellent presentation. Thank you for your comments, and thank you, Brookings, for inviting me. I agree that we are going through a technology revolution similar to the Industrial Revolution. And the question and challenge is, how do we make that revolution one that is going to be seen as empowering and opening up opportunity in communities and places left behind, as opposed to diminishing those opportunities? If you look at the Industrial Revolution, and there was income disparity for about 50 years. And in the beginning, people who could operate power looms were paid a premium. And then what happened is that many people learned how to operate power looms as the technology actually became less sophisticated, and there became less of a premium on operating power looms because technology became more accessible. Part of what could be happening even with artificial intelligence and robotics processing is the demystification of technology that actually allows it to be more accessible without the type of premiums that were necessary in much of the 90s and early 2000s. And so then the question becomes, what can we do to make sure that people are not just consumers of technology, but producers of technology? And every American is a consumer, more or less, of technology. And yet so many Americans feel like they are not participating in the production. They look at it and they say, well, there are going to be 6,000 Uber millionaires in Rose District and around there, and I'm not even making $15 an hour driving an Uber. Something is wrong with this picture. The president went and said it a little more starkly. You know, he went to communities and said, you built America, all these new people have come in, and they're making all the money. What happened to you? In a nutshell, that was the president's message. And so the challenge for us, I think, is how do we see technology to provide more economic opportunity by place? And it's both in rural communities and a long race. You know, John Lewis was one of my heroes in Congress, and I had gone down to Selma with him, and I was sharing my personal story of my grandfather, who had spent 4 years in jail with Gandhi, and he talked, which I didn't know, about Reverend Lawson and how he brought some of Gandhi's teachings to the nonviolent movement here. And at the end of it, he said, Ro, technology rights are the new civil rights. You're never going to solve a racial wealth gap where the average African-American has 7 cents to the dollar of someone who is white if there's no access to the places which are producing a large part of the wealth in the 21st century economy. So much of our focus has been distribution after production, but if you don't give people access to the means of production, you may solve some of the income inequality, but you're never going to solve a lot of the wealth inequality. And then when you go to rural communities in some places, and they want to have, they don't, you know, as I was in rural Iowa, and someone said to me, we don't want a handout and we don't want a ticket out. We want to have opportunity in these communities. The average average person, which I sent to my mother on Mother's Day, I don't do this, the average person lives 18 miles away from their mother in this country when they grow up. Most people want to live in the communities that they grew up in. They want to live next to their families. We can't tell them, I love Rod Chetty's work in terms of the economics, but the idea that to say go move, people don't want to move. You know, people don't want to come live in Palo Alto or Fremont. They want to live in love in the communities that they've been in. So our task, and we can discuss this more, is how do we create the technology and opportunity in these communities so that they see that they have a better opportunity now than they ever have and that they don't have to move. That was the promise of technology. And the fight of the future is going to be whether we can deliver on that promise. Can we show that technology actually is going to be a liberating, transformational force where people have more economic opportunity in the communities they grew up in than they ever had before? If we succeed in that, I think we build to a more pluralistic, inclusive America. And on the alternative, is technology going to be the type of force that we've seen so far, which is co-location, economic concentration with a lot of people left out?
So on that point, Mitty, you have done a lot around creating a marketplace, and then you talk about the tools being used enough for lots of people to learn. I call that putting the means of production in people's hands, as Representative Connor talked about. Talk about that and what you think it means in terms of opportunity. And then I didn't catch the details. You guys did something about making the platform open to the public. Just trying to figure out how that fits into the mix.
So at Automation Anywhere, we do believe that technology is an enabler, and to Congressman Rowe's point, it must be accessible. And so what we've tried to do from a corporate accountability and responsibility point of view is try and open up that platform to the public. So we have a community edition that is basically free. It is exactly the same as our corporate edition that all corporations use. And it is to put that in the hands of the people. So any person or small business could use this tool in order to better themselves or better their work environment, better change careers, you know, morph into certain other careers, or whatever else they might want to. We also have Automation Anywhere University, again, with the same concept, with bringing the training to the people, because unless you can get trained, and unless you can get trained by and large free to some extent, how do you transition? How do you make sure the society is enabled to transition? So we've done these two things. We also have a community marketplace where you can say, you know, I've trained myself. I have the community platform now. I create those software bots, and I can create an ecosystem where I can now sell it, I can rent it, I can monetize it, and therefore create that economy around the bots and enable people to be part of that economy themselves, give them the means to do so.
So it's basically an app store for bots.
It's an app store for bots. And it is. We have over 500 bots already. And now these can be small bots, they can be end-to-end process bots, and again, the concept is how can we democratize it? Somebody might be a specialist in a small area, somebody might be a specialist in a larger area, in a different vertical. How can we just enable them to do what they're really great at and bring that to commerce, bring that to economically viable and sustainable for the society means?
So some of the companies in Representative Connor's district have, let's talk about the App Store analog, have invested in building pretty broad and distributed developer communities. Is that, you guys have put the tools out there, are you actively cultivating a developer community, and are you thinking about geographic distribution in that process?
Absolutely. So we do a developer community where they are kind of more technical developers or subject matter experts, as we call them. So they might do end-to-end processing. And then we also have communities where they are newbies. So they are business analysts who are creating bots, because this has to be democratized. It cannot be centered around one particular job description, really. And so we have a community across all of that. It's as wide as you'd like it to be. And that community is public, so you can create your own ecosystem or your own smaller community or a niche community that could serve your purposes in that sense as well.
So that's a really tangible example of how corporations can lean in to actually create platforms and pathways for people to ramp into the new sector. Representative Connor, you've talked actually about how we rebuild our systems at scale in order to be able to do that across the country. And why don't you talk about some of the things that you're proposing as solutions in this space? And I don't know what the pushback is, but it'd be great to understand what the pushback is, if there is any.
Well, let's take an example with robotics processing, and then I can talk more broadly. But, you know, and you understand this far more, I'll try to provide my understanding. I mean, basically, you know, when you order, let's say, something online, a lot of the chats and now that you engage in are, have been automated. And the software that's being discussed is what allows some of that automation for chat and automation of business processes. Now, that's going to create a whole opportunity of industry of people who are going to be trained and understand that technology that probably is not going to require a college education, may not require, frankly, more than 6 to 9 months of credentialing. But the opportunity in the window is probably the next few years. And what will happen if we don't seize that window as a country is those jobs are likely going to get offshored. They will get offshored to the same countries where so many tech jobs were offshored. So there has to be an intentionality in our country of saying, okay, we understand that this is a sector, an area which is going to create a lot of jobs. Let's make sure that those jobs are distributed across the country, and let's have a collaboration, as Jim pointed out, between the government, between regional businesses, between community colleges, and the private sector to say, okay, what are we going to do to get people the credentials, to get these jobs, to make sure that this industry is in the United States? Why have we not been historically focused on this? I would argue bluntly that for a long time, we didn't have the same sense of urgency in this country. We were focused largely on consumer welfare as opposed to jobs, especially after the Cold War. We were the only game in town, and we never really thought that we're going to have to think about good-paying jobs. Well, we no longer have that luxury. And in most other countries, from the time someone's 7 or 8, they think about, how am I going to get a good-paying job? Both Jim and I served President Obama, and I don't make this as a partisan comment because I think it could continue in this administration. There was a program that Megan Smith started called Tech Hire that was designed to do exactly this, to think about, okay, what are the new industries? Where is the community? What can we do to make sure that people are getting those skills? And the reason the private sector is important, and it has to be a holistic approach, is I was down in, and I don't want to mention the community because I don't want to embarrass them, but there was a community college that was teaching folks how to replace hard drives. And I was thinking, okay, now you're wasting all this money in a community college that's not going to lead to a job, and then you're going to get more people saying these job training programs don't work, and we're wasting money, and just this sense of dysfunction. So you have to involve the private sector, you have to involve government and the regional communities to have a job at the end of the tunnel and be very intentional in the industry. What could the government do? Let me suggest three things. I have no idea why this country can't get a commitment to have universal high-speed internet in every part of America. $40 billion, that's the amount of money we spend 1 year in Afghanistan. I challenge anyone to go around the country and say, do you think it's more important for America's competitiveness in the 21st century for every part of this nation to have high-speed broadband, or do you think we should stay in one more year in Afghanistan? I mean, 18 years, if you'll permit me one digression. President Trump called President Carter, and he said, "I'm concerned about China. They're getting ahead of us." And President Carter said, "Well, China hasn't been in a war since 1979. They're building high-speed rail. They're building broadband. Why aren't we investing in our country to build those opportunities?" That would be one thing I would do. The second thing I would do is be intentional about federal software contracts. Make sure some of them have to be done in 10% in rural America or in communities of color so that you're incentivizing businesses to have metrics, metrics of hiring to help make sure that the distribution of these economic opportunities are more broad-based. And third thing that I would prioritize is massive investments in technology institutes, whether they're at the HBCUs or at land-grant universities, to give resources, but that it collaborate with the private sector so that communities can develop the basic credentialing and skills for the jobs of the future. Why hasn't it been done? I don't know. Why has the Congress not been able to do anything in the last there's a gridlock in our political system that is the biggest cost. I mean, there are a lot of things, in my view, this president's done that have a moral stain, like separating kids from their parents. But the biggest cost of our last few years has been inaction. We're paralyzed. And the challenge, I fundamentally believe, as you do, that this country's great, extraordinary because of our values. But we are faced with a new type of competition, which is authoritarian capitalism. Not fascism, not communism, but authoritarian capitalism with a state with very little regard for civil liberties goes and says, I want to just build something, and they build it. And the challenge for America, with our extraordinary multicultural makeup and with our extraordinary messiness of democracy, are we capable of acting with decisiveness to build the investments we need to deal with the technology revolution? The good news is, in the past, America has always risen to that challenge, but it's going to require a new generation to do that.
Please. Can I add to his comments? I absolutely agree with you. There was a stat that we had which said 4% of American jobs require a medium level of creativity. And so we must train society for the new jobs, for the jobs of the future, the jobs that are going to be in the next 20 years leading the world and everything. And so I absolutely agree. We need to train people on the newer technologies, on the newer methods, because that's how this is going to play out, really it is. And again, coming back to automation, which is my world, this is what we have seen in the last even 5 years. We have seen, instances where a customer, for example, has brought out a cure for cancer 3 years earlier than they expected because of the automation. We work with an organization called People Shows that we just talked about, where we have retrained a youth of with limited opportunities to do move from a low income job or a minimum wage job to a $100,000 job within about 3 to 6 months. This is what we can bring to society with technology if it is done right, if it is done with communities, if it is done with government, and that has to be part of the equation because it has been tried and tested now. It's time to take it to scale.
Good deal. So I'm going to give you guys a second to start formulating your questions. I think I have like 2 minutes before I'm supposed to get there. Oh, excellent. Oh, great. And I get to ask my next question. So the interesting thing is that the other Einstein quote, which is often really misused, is imagination is more important than education. And the really context was it that in order to solve problems that have never been solved before, you have to be able to envision a solution that doesn't exist. But you all have both, we've spent a lot of time talking about solving this problem through skills. You both have talked about creativity in some form or fashion. I haven't heard anything about what that looks like in this context. And I don't know if you even have an idea of what it means to begin to think about how we actually develop people to be more creative problem solvers in these contexts. But I wondered if either of you actually had that in mind. Feel free to say no.
I can share a few customer stories if that helps.
That'd be
you.
Great.
Where we learn from customers as to how, again, we are technologists from an automation point of view, right? So they come from their world and they tell us that just having gotten rid of the things that really don't add that value enables them to have time. Sometimes you just don't have the time to think outside the box or be creative because you have the skill set, you know your subject, you know your industry that you're working in, you know it really well. And if you only had the time or the bandwidth, really, to kind of think outside the box, they bring that creativity. And that enables that creative outlet, you know, to come to that next level of whatever it is, whether it's even customer service or whether it is innovation. Just the fact that you can, you know, have blood tests without errors being given, you know, changes the game. And that's what automation can bring to it. So I believe from a creative angle, it is a direct match. The more you automate everything that can be automated, the more creative capacity you can unleash.
I would say, so, Jim, obviously there are new industry, new skills we need to educate for, but some of this is a question of basic values and what our society is committed to doing. I was back home on Sunday in Fremont, and I met with a group in Santa Clara, the Black Engineers Association, and they told me a statistic that I found startling. I mean, some of you may know this. Only 33% of Black students in this country go to a high school that offers calculus as an option. 33%. Think about that. I mean, 67% of Black students, talking about the place you grew up, will never have the opportunity after high school to apply for most schools to get into a science or technology program because they don't even have the option of taking calculus. Now, that doesn't require an understanding of new skills or new technologies. That's just a question of why in our society, in a 21st century economy, are we not making the commitment to have basic science and technology proficiency in every high school in this country, right? When you look at the income that you talked about and gaps, I mean, that, of course, some of it is new industries. Some of it is that there's been a decline in the national share of income, and so the experts here know more, from about 58% that used to go to workers to 54%. And we have perpetuated an economic system that rewards investment and capital more than rewards investment in workforce. We haven't raised the minimum wage. We haven't helped unionization. We've provided tax incentives for depreciation instead of workforce investment. So, yes, it's about new industries, but it's also thinking through the economic system that we have created and what that has meant for the accumulation of wealth for some and the decline of the middle class. And then finally, yes, we ought to be investing in new industries and new credentialing. And I don't, I mean, whether that's in synthetic biology or whether it's in photonics or whether it's in other forms of research, and making that distributed across the country. And I think that's necessary for competitiveness in new industries. But we shouldn't think that that type of investment is going to solve some of the structural inequality, given that we haven't taken steps to solve the structural inequalities in the current industries.
So, I mean, you create a great path for us to think about the layering of these kinds of interventions that we're going to need to have in order to make the transition. And also, you talked briefly about the things that we need to be able to help people prepare. There already was in prior years an investment in connecting all of the high schools and, frankly, all the schools in the country to high-speed internet. You talked about the investment for the rest of the communities and building these tech institutes. Have you put any thought into the connection among them in place? You described one opportunity where people have done that. Are there others where you're seeing institutions at the higher ed level and schools and employers really starting to crack the code on how you actually create these pathways?
I think that's such a good point, Jim, because my experience has been that it can't just be someone in Silicon Valley or someone in Washington making something work in a community. In fact, there was a heartbreaking story in the New York Times about a place in West Virginia where a well-intentioned nonprofit went in to try to teach coal miners skills of coding, and they got millions of dollars, and it didn't work. And of course, that's the story the press will write about. But it was because they didn't have enough local buy-in. Contrast that with, let's say, Jefferson, Iowa, where you've had a local company, Pillar Technology, partnering with Des Moines Community College, partnering with the governor's office, getting certain resources from the local county, and there is a commitment there to having people learn basic software skills, live in this rural community, and get a $65,000 job after 2 years. But it was a concerted effort. Now, they partnered with Silicon Valley. The Tech Museum went in for 3 days to help teach or partner with the Des Moines Community College faculty about what the curriculum should be that'll be most conducive to 21st century thinking and 21st century jobs. But the initial sort of infrastructure had buy-in from all the local stakeholders. And, you know, I had gone down to Jim Clyburn's district, and you saw the same there with some of the HBCUs and local communities. And so I think that that point is so important, which is why I think Tech Hire, not to keep counting it, was such a good model, because that was based on building this local partnership and infrastructure and then fueling it with investment.
Agreed. Now, just really quickly, you talked about the opening up of the platforms, but are you seeing more deliberate efforts by people to take the tools that you provided and to build programs around them to actually prepare people for this economy?
Absolutely. For example, there are universities and colleges that are using it. Then there are organizations like PeopleSource that basically will train, youth without opportunity, or train people who are looking for transitions, people of domestic violence, etc. And they kind of set up these centers just to train, and they train them, and then they get them jobs with other partners or customers looking for RPA, for example, RPA bot developers or bot creators, as we call them. They might also add it to the bot store and actually monetize it for, so that the nonprofit also has a regular source of income to continue that training. So we absolutely see it across the board, and we see it across the world, not just in the U.S. And it's a great model because it not just allowing people to take it, the nonprofit sector, the education sector, they are really good at what they do. And but just by enabling them to take it to that next level, giving technology to them in their hands so that they can train and that they can then influence the next generation of work, is very, very important. And that is part of that societal movement, I think. And we've seen great success with it.
Great. So as we transition to Q&A from you, one last question, which is, we're grateful to Google.org for the investment that they've made. You've provided a great example. You're representing many of these technology companies. If you had one or two things that you'd say you'd like to see the broader technology community, corporate community do to lean into this issue and problem, what would you say people ought to be doing?
Well, they need to do more than one or two things. They have to recognize.
I'll give you three.
Go. Got to recognize that at the head of the spear of the technology revolution, they have an obligation to create greater equity. And so, I would say three things: one, expand the imagination and where you're hiring from, and some of the companies are doing that. They're making more conscious efforts to partner with HBCUs, to partner with state schools, to partner not just with the traditional universities to look at where to get talent. Two, I would say really expand into communities, both into rural communities and communities of color, and where you can hire people and provide concrete examples of success, where if even if it's 20 people, 30 people in a community, that can change the entire aspiration of a community. And then third, I would say, is make sure that you are a model when, in terms of paying your workers, both the people, not just at your company, but the subcontractors, the janitorial workers, the food service workers, the building bus drivers, a decent wage, decent benefits, so that people don't think that only the rewards of technology are only accruing to the very top.
Got it. Edie?
I agree with everything that has been said. Corporations, apart from just building technology, corporations in every vertical and every industry must kind of have a mindset to enable. And if you have that mindset to enable, then I think the sky's the limit. It's really imaginative in that sense. You know, what can you do to bring this technology, make it more accessible, make whatever your services and products are more accessible to the community at large? And I think just having that consciousness and that a plan of action around it and being very specific about it, you know, these are the things that we will do immediately. These are the things that we will do in the next year and so forth, versus just having a mindset to do it but not taking steps immediately to start that process, I think is important for corporations to look at.
So actually get something done.
You must. You have to.
Awesome. Okay, so quite. This is the question and answer period. I remind you there's like a question part to the question and answer part. I will apologize in advance if you don't do that. Sir. That's you, yeah. Oh.
Chris McRae, Norman McRae Foundation. So you talked about exponentials, and obviously one of the most famous exponentials of all is Moore's Law, doubling every 18 months, actually 100-fold every decade from 1970. So my father and The Economist actually wrote a survey on, you know, why isn't there a Silicon Valley everywhere back in 1980? And over the last 40 years, what we have concluded is the logjam is in education. It's in the teachers. It's in the missing curriculum. So what I'm wondering is, actually you do the maths. We now have, by 2030, 1 trillion times more technology of the Moore's Law type than when we had to race to the moon. How do we get a curriculum in the 2020s that even third grade students and teachers can map back from the future of all this technology you're talking about? Because otherwise, all these bits and pieces really are not going to help Americans at all. Singapore is already mapping such a curriculum. So that's one example. You know, how do we do something better than Singapore?
You guys want me to take this one?
Sure.
My other passion is how do we actually get the kind of R&D and breakthrough R&D and education and development that we actually need? So a couple of things. One, some of the structural stuff. We don't invest in R&D in the education space the way we do in other sectors. We don't actually have the infrastructure in place. So just to put into context, in the military and defense, we invest roughly at the federal level $80 billion. We invest less than two if you're really, really generous at the federal level. So not putting the resources behind how you actually get real breakthroughs is a part of the problem. The second thing is that we have successfully taken a world that is inherently interesting and figured out how to make it so reductionist that almost every student describes school as boring, right? And so the question for us is, how do you actually then enliven the curriculum around things that are relevant and actually allow for real problem solving in the context of being able to teach them the competencies and the skills that they need? That's the design challenge, and we've actually not been very good at putting it forward in a way that lets people be responsive to it, but that's also tied to the third challenge. We still devalue teachers. And in order to have teachers that can teach a complex problem-based curriculum, you have to have people who have high levels of competence themselves. And you have to provide them with tools and resources to make it work. We have actually not provided either. Like, other than throwing it up on a screen, we basically still have teachers have colored markers and pens. No other tools for actually understanding exactly what students know and don't know, being able to match it to better content and supports. Those things, when you ask a teacher to do the basic work of teaching. Think about it. Average elementary school classroom is about 35 students. So chop off the last two rows, that's basically it. I, as a teacher in elementary school, am expected to come in and know what each and every one of you knows, what you don't know, what you're interested in, match it to the perfect content and instructional approach every day. Think about that task. Think about the cognitive load in that task. And then say, what tool have I been given to help me do that? What tools have I been given to help me do that? Now, say, I'm a secondary school teacher. That means I teach somewhere between 125 and 250 kids a day. Do you wonder why your kids' papers don't come back graded? So all of this is about how we do the work that Rebecca has been talking about, of how we create a real revolution in innovation in the education and learning space that can actually help us keep up with the changing times and create opportunity for people who don't have it today. We got to do it cheap, too, by the way. Go ahead.
Thank you, Larry Checco, senior advisor to Serve USA. And I've got a teacher, and I can relate to exactly what you're saying. It's very frustrating for them. But I'd like to posit the idea of a national service program to bridge some of these gaps. From kids from 18 to 26 who don't know what to do after they go to high school, to hook them up with private industry, to have them go through almost apprenticeship-type programs, incentivize them. It's a two-year commitment. At the end, they would get something similar to a GI Bill that would help them advance themselves. I think this is a real notion.
That's a great idea. I think people are toying around with ideas like that. In fact, there's a pretty big initiative around apprenticeship that's moving nationally. You might want to connect with them. Did I see another hand over here?
Yeah, and I know that Brookings is going to do something on national service in October. Thank you.
Fantastic. Thanks. We'll go here. I saw a hand back there, then I'll come back up to you. Is that okay?
Hi. Thanks for such an interesting start today. This has been really interesting to me. I'm from an organization called GSMA. Probably no one's ever heard of it, but we're the trading association for the mobile industry, but maybe more interesting for this discussion is on the foundation side. We work with mobile operators all over the world to investigate how mobile technology can have a positive impact. So most of our work is on low-income countries, but we're now exploring how we can have the same transformational, liberating impact in developed countries, including the U.S. I've been really encouraged to hear the private sector mentioned a few times, and my takeaways are that maybe there's an opportunity for mobile operators, so mobile phone companies in the U.S. and mobile technology to do a few things.
Sorry, sir. Do you have a question?
Yeah, I'm getting to it. Sorry.
Okay. Thanks.
One is addressing connectivity in urban and rural areas. The other one is supporting digital skills and also just being good employers and making sure economic opportunities are available in rural communities as well. My question is, of the opportunities we talked about today, which one should we be telling mobile operators to focus on most urgently, and what kind of partnerships should we be advising they put in place to make sure that the impact is sustainable and meaningful? Sorry for the long intro, but I thought that might be helpful.
Well, I would say expansion of hiring is probably the biggest thing that someone can do, and then having that be a pathway to a good job. And that's something concrete that mobile carriers or many tech companies can do.
Do you want to add anything?
Not really.
Good deal. Back here.
Hi, my name is Christina Fitzpatrick. I'm with the AARP. And there's been uniquely human skills are going to be really important in the future. So, Anita, you mentioned creativity. Do you know of any programs that are effective at teaching those kinds of human skills and enhancing people's ability to be creative?
I don't know of any programs offhand, I apologize, but we can come back to figuring that out, I guess. But I agree with what Jim said. It is about enabling our teachers to get to that next level. How do we teach creativity? And putting tools and time in their hands and really, teaching our students for the next generation versus, what we already know. So, no, I don't know of any offhand.
There are some, an increasing number of evidence-based programs around social, emotional, and integrated with academic development. One of the more important things to remember is that programs are not the main thing. It really is about the environments and the relationships that young people find themselves in that lead to them developing the skills to create other environments where they have human connection and can form relationships. So it will not necessarily show up in the form of a program, but in the kinds of environments we create. Here.
Gene Allen, I have a company called Decision Insight. The challenge is, and I want to thank you guys for exceptional presentations. How do we teach people to learn? Because by the time you learn something, it's
over,
potentially out of date. And the challenge is teaching, not just teaching everybody, it's teaching masses to learn quickly enough so that they're individually empowered. So you have to teach the teachers how to learn quickly to stay on top of the technologies and the tools that they're teaching with. So learning becomes really the work of the future.
So you made a pretty powerful statement in that, which is learning is the work of the future. And so we have to first recognize that. I don't know if you have something you want to say on this topic, or I can keep going.
I mean, I agree with you. I mean, there's a great book, Startup of You, by Reid Hoffman, where he makes more or less this point that you have to be a lifelong learner. You have to understand that you'll have many career changes. I mean, my father came to this country as an immigrant and had the same job for 30 years with the same company and then retired. And that's unlikely to be the path for most people. And so giving, inculcating that from a a young age where people understand that it's not just, okay, you're done with school and then you're done with education, but that this is something, this is an approach that's going to be necessary for success your entire life. I think having that in the curriculum.
Technology is already moving in that direction. So the newer technologies, including the ones we produce, the learning curve is 2 weeks to 2 months. And so then it's a question of, you know, wanting it, enabling it, making sure it's talked about, communicated, so that people have that opportunity. Newer technologies will take, hopefully, shorter time spans and shorter learning curves for people to onboard into it.
There's the part also about the mindsets, the behaviors, and the skills, right? And the mindsets that you need to be a continuous learner, to be able to persist through difficulty and all of those good things are things that are currently underemphasized, talked about a lot, but underemphasized in how you actually, in practice, help instill them in young people as they're growing and, frankly, restore them in adults who have had it beaten the heck out of them. The second thing, though, is then that the ideas that go along and the skills that go along with actually seeking out new knowledge, being able to navigate systems to accumulate knowledge and find the resources that can be helpful, that also is a skill set. And we've not prepared people for needing to do that for the rest of their lives, nor put them through systems where they have choice about what they actually learn. And so I can't help but imagine that kind of environment is going to be required in order to prepare people for what's coming in the future. I don't think any of us know exactly what it looks like, but I do think you're seeing more and more school models pop up where that kind of choice is built in, and more programs at the post-secondary level where people are given the flexibility to begin to make choices along the way with support and guidance, and that pathway then stays available to them for a long period of time, whether it's coming back to the same university or subscription programs like a Pluralsight that lets you keep continuous learning, not to name a commercial provider, but are others as well. Okay, I think we have time for two more, and there's a question back here. Go.
Thank you. I'm Nate Sava. My name is Amit Sava. Pleasure to be here. Mm-hmm. I had a question on China and the comparison between the U.S. and China, given China's...
Can you take on the mic?
Can you hear me?
We might, but the people on the internet definitely can't.
Let's try one more time. All right, there we go. Oh, I sound more manly. I wanted to ask a question about the American model versus the Chinese model. As you look increasingly throughout the world, leaders in Africa and Asia and elsewhere are seeing the way China seems to have their act together on technology adoption, on upskilling for the future of work. And there's a perception in many parts of the world that we're falling behind. What can we do, given some of the gridlock that Congressman Connor mentioned? What can we do here in the U.S. to give hope and to provide an alternative model, to be that beacon of hope that we have in so many ways and for so much of our history? How do we maintain that as we look to this new threat that China's providing?
Well, I was with Condoleezza Rice she's at Stanford, and she said, you know, if you want to make sure we stay ahead of the Chinese, then make sure we give any Chinese student who wants to come here and start businesses here a green card. Part of our advantage is our immigration and the restriction on and climate affair of immigration is, in my view, one of the biggest detriments to our competitiveness. How are we going to compete with 1.4 billion people if we're not a magnet for attracting talent? We also need to mobilize science and technology, much like we mobilized science and technology after Sputnik. Federal research in places like NIH, NSF, DARPA have fallen to less than 1% of GDP, where they were at one point at 3% of GDP. Why aren't we making those basic investments in science and technology to make sure we're ahead of the new in new industries? Look, I think China has a lot of problems. I mean, obviously, their human rights abuses. They're not nearly still as entrepreneurial as a culture. I think the rule of law is not as strong. I think we have 60% of the top universities. If we can just make sure that those of us in Congress don't get in the way, we should be fine.
So yes to everything that was just said. The thing that I would add is that we also have to kind of challenge the narrative that the Chinese education system as it exists today is superior to at least what the best of our education system does, especially for the economy that's coming. When you talk to folks that are in China or, frankly, in India today, what they talk about is the rote system that actually perpetuates through most of their system, that it's actually only a few students who actually get to participate in systems that allow them to begin to expand and become a part of the creative society. And then it's also another reason that so many of the very, very top students wind up coming here, not just to stay, but because of the quality of the education here. What we have to do is figure out how we expand the best of what we have to all the rest of our students and how we create more incentives for our students to continue in the educational process so that all of the folks who have the kind of expertise that you get at the doctorate level and are needed now in many cases for AI, machine learning, and some of the advances that we need, where they actually have the incentives and the resources to stay in the game and pull from a much broader base of Americans than we do today. That's where we're going to get the innovation. Okay, last question here. Yes.
I am a teacher, so I follow directions.
Okay. Good morning. I'm Jane Chadsey, and I lead a small nonprofit in Seattle, Washington, called EduCurious. We're an ed tech company. And I want to get back to something that you said right off the bat, and that is technology is going to lead to a better society. So mine is a really big question about the intersection of technology and education is, what does that society look like? If it's better, how is it different than it is today? And what role can education play in that?
That's a loaded question.
It's at least a big question. You got like a minute and a half.
I have a pretty big imagination. So for me, I don't see 30 years ago what society was and what society is today. If you take anything from healthcare to banking to, you know, a person moving between cities, or it can be anything, logistics, government services, it doesn't matter. I think we have moved a far, far way. If you just take a point in time 30 years ago and you take a point in time today, society has advanced unbelievably. Now, what technology is doing is that it's creating that exponential curve in growth. So between now and, let's say, 30 years from now, if you take two points in time, I think we'll have longer lifespans, less child deaths, less displacement when not needed. Hopefully, we've fed the world, so to speak. We have education opportunities for everybody. Just the fact that the internet exists, look at what has happened to information, how much accessibility there has been to the society as a whole, and how much we learn because of that. You know, people who haven't been to school even have access to information, which they didn't before. At least they know they're not educated. They didn't even know they were actually behind in some ways because of that lack of communication.
I'm going to interrupt you because I want to give you a chance to use this to kind of close out if there's anything else you want to say, and I'll let the representative have another chance and then...
Absolutely. So I think it'll be a much, much better place, a happier, safer, and more socially connected place. And so I think that's what technology will bring to the world.
Well, maybe I'll answer the same question to try to offer a close. Technology inherently is amoral. I mean, technology can help us in solving material needs and in improving the human condition in medicine and in giving access to more information. But I think what this country needs is more thinkers, is more humanists, is more people with the judgment to shape the rules of how we're going to use the technology to be enhancing, to how we're going to make sure that different people have access to that technology, how we're going to understand how to find common ground despite different perspectives. So it's really for more liberal arts thinking and teachers and humanists to help shape the world and shape technology in a way that will be positive.
And to close it out, I'll just tell the end of a story, which is, for those who are familiar, the two wolves that are fighting inside. And the answer of the one that will win is the one that you feed. It's going to be up to us how technology is going to influence what kind of society we have. But to the congressman's point, we have to make some pretty bold and deliberate decisions quickly. And if we don't, it will happen to us, not with us. Thank you, everyone. Thank you. Let's get kicked off the mic.